are three things that I think you should probably know about today. We are learning that Israel was furious with Charlie Kirk for turning on them. We're also learning that Charlie was called to a secret meeting in the Hamptons where he was scolded and given a beatdown of sorts before he died. And we're also learning that after that meeting, Charlie did not relent, and he even turned down a meeting with Bibi Netanyahu. This is the Sanchez effect. What do you say we do this, huh? Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's talk Charlie Kirk, because there's some new information out there, and it's kind of creepy. Creepy, yeah. First, understand that Charlie Kirk was owned by Israel. All right, I'm gonna put it a different way. Here's a better way to say it. They thought they owned him. There has been ample reporting on this, by the way. In fact, it's not even really reporting. Charlie has admitted this while he was alive. He talked about his trips to Israel, his financial backing from Israel, directly or indirectly from Israel or Zionist millionaires and billionaires in the United States. And because Charlie was a Christian nationalist, he had originally bought into this notion that Israel was somehow the fulfillment of a biblical prophecy that tied him and other Christians to Israel. The Bible said so, right? In other words, at the time, he probably didn't need a whole lot of coaxing. And he became very, very useful to the Netanyahu government. You got that? Good. Now, let's move on. Because Charlie moved on. You see, Charlie Kirk started to change. First and foremost, he became a Catholic after getting married to a woman who was a Catholic. Catholics are different. Unlike a lot of Protestants and evangelical ministers in the United States, priests don't take money from Israel in exchange for proffering a pro-Israel narrative. It's just, you know, they may have other issues, but that's not one of them. So as Charlie became more Catholic, more independent, he began to question Israel's actions in Gaza, and he did it more and more. Then he committed what may have been seen as the ultimate betrayal in the eyes of Israel and its fanatical followers in the United States. He invited critics of Israel, people like Tucker Carlson, to his very well-attended and very well-covered Turning Point USA conference. This is a big deal. And people like Tucker Carlson show up and they start speaking. And this was the headline event that I'm about to show you. Here's Tucker saying something about Jeffrey Epstein and connecting him publicly for the first time in front of all these MAGA folks to Israel.
The real answer is Jeffrey Epstein was working on behalf of intel services, probably not American. And we have every right to ask, on whose behalf was he working? How does a guy go from being a math teacher at the Dalton School in the late 70s with no college degree to having multiple airplanes, a private island, and the largest residential house in Manhattan? Where did all the money come from? And no one has ever gotten to the bottom of that because no one has ever tried. And moreover, it's extremely obvious to anyone who watches that this guy had direct connections to a foreign government. Now, no one's allowed to say that that foreign government is Israel because we have been somehow cowed into thinking that that's naughty.
Did you hear that applause? It was almost like a relief applause. Oh my God, he said it. We're not allowed to say it, but he just said it. And they were overtaken by the moment and they all started applauding, right? Look, that applause is not something Israel would want to hear. But it's a message that was burning like fire at the time through podcasts, the MAGA movement, independent journalists like Carlson and Kelly and Napolitano, Bannon, Cenk Uygur, us here, Jimmy Dore, the left, the right, everything in between. Charlie Kirk was engaging with many of those people that I just named, inviting in their ideas. So was Israel's golden boy biting the hand that had fed him so well? Look, there's no question that Charlie at the time was feeling pressure from Israel. It was coming from Israel. In August, I'm going to show you something now. He goes and does an interview with Megyn Kelly, where he clearly speaks to the pressure he's getting from Israel.
The way you are treating me is so repulsive. I have text messages, Megan, calling me an anti-Semite. My moral character is now being put into question, Megan. Not my decisions, not like, hey, are you doing this? Is it smart or is it dumb? But no, I am a bad person if I do this. I have less ability sometimes online to criticize the Israeli government without backlash than actual Israelis do. I feel the connection to Israel, and But at the same time, simultaneously, when the hostile reaction is that now Megan and Charlie are enemies,
right?
Boy, I'll tell you, like you're not gonna. I wouldn't say lose, but you will weaken and just basically deflate two of your strongest advocates if that continues.
So there it is. It was a schism, right? You see it developing, right? A fracture. Suddenly, Charlie Kirk has joined the billion or so other people all over the world, who are questioning what the hell Israel is doing in Gaza. So what, right? Like I said, people all over the world are taking on Israel. Why should it matter that he is taking on Israel? It does matter. You know why? Because Charlie was different. You see, Israel felt like he was beholden to them, or should have been. He traveled there. He took money from them. He was tied to them privately and publicly. Should they stand by and allow their most important spokesperson in the MAGA movement ever to turn on them or even just allow him to waver on these issues? Okay, here's the answer. Now, I didn't know this until this morning. According to investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, who's a damn good reporter, by the way, he's been on this show many times. Apparently not. Apparently not. Israel was not willing to do that. Blumenthal is now reporting that about the same time or just before he did that interview that I just showed you, that Charlie did with Megyn Kelly, where he said that he was feeling a lot of pressure. He wasn't just feeling the pressure. He was actually getting the pressure. Blumenthal is reporting, right, that according to his sources, Charlie was called to a secret meeting in New York, a secret meeting in the Hamptons with Israel's man in America. That would be billionaire Bill Ackman, where he was, quote, given a bit of a beatdown. Listen.
And these were people who had knowledge of a tumultuous, stormy meeting held in the Hamptons during the first week of August, convened, according to multiple sources, with knowledge of this meeting, intimate knowledge of this meeting, by the billionaire ultra-Zionist financier Bill Ackman, who is close to Netanyahu and his kind of network in the United States. Charlie Kirk was summoned along with an array of young, sort of vapid, very avaricious conservative influencers who seem to be sort of in Israel's back pocket to set a very pro-Israel tone for this meeting. And Charlie Kirk was, according to one source, hammered by Ackman and others for allowing Israel critics, very prominent conservative voices like Megyn Kelly, Tucker Carlson, or the anti-Zionist Jewish comedian Dave Smith to appear at his events.
They were mad because he allowed those people to appear at his events. Did you hear that? Secret meeting called in the Hamptons. Blumenthal is not saying that he knows or has proof or has any reporting on the fact that Israel was responsible for Charlie's assassination. That wouldn't be correct, nor would it be responsible to even intimate that at this point. But he does report, as do many others, that there are conclusions so far that have been reported regarding, I'm sure you've seen him yourself, I've been reading up on him, on Charlie's manner of death, that are very suspect. And there's no question it's too soon. A lot more still needs to be learned about what really happened here before we jump to any conclusions. Meanwhile, though, Mr. Ackman, for his part, is saying this about Kirk, as reported by a Zionist news outlet. Take a listen.
You know, I think there's a radicalization that's happened globally, and it only takes one bad actor to have such a tragedy. Charlie was a very important voice. While his death is a tragedy, you know, he hopefully will not die in vain.
Wow. There's more, though, because you know that Candace Owens is going to get involved in this, and she is. Isn't that funny? All these people who are part of the MAGA movement are now the ones who are coming forward and saying these things that they're just not happy with, as a lot of people are who voted for Mr. Trump and are now questioning what the hell is going on. Candace Owens is adding to this intrigue with her own take on what happened to Charlie and her own reporting on what happened to Charlie just before his killing. She says she knows about this type of pressure that he was under because she says the same thing happened to her. She also says that Charlie was called to Israel and offered even more money for his organization if he would get back on, you know, board with them and start doing the things that he's supposed to do and saying the things that he's supposed to say. They'll double the money. They'll give him more for his organization. He was already getting $83 million, according to reports that I have seen. And then they threw in, you know, a sweetener. They said, we're also going to get you a meeting directly, you and Netanyahu. Mr. Netanyahu wants to sit down and talk to you. Maybe you can get a little more. Charlie said no and no.
And I know for a fact that Charlie denied that funding. That Charlie denied, and what Bibi didn't include there, he declined to go to Israel for, I would describe this as, like, you know, re-education camp, you know. We've seen it. You made an uh-oh, but we can help you. You know, we just need you to come out to Auschwitz and take a picture. Yeah. We just need you to come to the Holocaust Museum and take a photo. We just need you to go to Israel and we can make this better. Charlie said no to Bibi.
Charlie said no to Bibi. I'm telling you guys, when I started looking into this story this morning, it was like an onion. And I kept taking, you know, more and more of the skin off of the onion. And I kept learning more and more about stuff that looks creepy. Like I said at the beginning, it's like, what's going on here? And there's more. It continues, at least on the anti-Israel sentiment, which is continuing to galvanize in the United States. And in some measure, the latest part of this story is being led, gosh, almost like right from the grave by Charlie himself. See, before Charlie died, if you're asking, well, how the hell is that going to happen, right? How can that be? So before he was killed, Charlie put out a tweet. In it, he criticizes this new law that Congress is trying to pass, which is crazy, crazy law. They're trying to pass a law to increase even more the penalties that already exist. If you're an American living in America, an American citizen, and you dare criticize Israel, you can criticize the United States, you can criticize Russia, China, Cuba, Mexico, Canada, anybody. But if you dare, as an American, to criticize Israel or boycott Israel or assist in a boycott of Israel, you know what? You're going to be punished. And Charlie's response to this thing still lives. It's not one that Israel is going to want to hear or would have wanted to hear when he was still alive. But let me read it for you. Here it is. He says, tomorrow, the House will vote on H.R. 867, a bill that will criminalize private boycotts of Israel, fines of up to $1 million, and prison time of up to 20 years. He goes on to write, bills like this only create more anti-Semitism and play into growing narratives that Israel is running the United States government. He writes, in America, you are allowed to hold differing views. You are allowed to disagree and protest. And then he finishes with this, which is interesting. This bill should not pass, he wrote. Any Republican that votes for this bill will expose themselves. We will be watching very closely, he wrote. It's a heck of a thing, isn't it? And it kind of leaves one to wonder. I know it leaves me to wonder. Was Bibi Netanyahu also watching this closely? I bet he was. I bet he was. After the break, we're going to be joined by Cynthia McKinney. None other than Cynthia McKinney. She is a legend, U.S. independent politician, former Democratic congresswoman, never afraid to say exactly what she thought. Got a lot of trouble for it, but that's what truth tellers have happened to them, right? She's on a trip to the Donbass. We're going to be talking to her about that, her thoughts, Ukrainian conflict, Charlie Kirk, Israel, Gaza, so much. This is going to be really good. Don't go away.
Georgia P.
The woman that you are about to be introduced you to, in case you don't know her, by the way, is, let me see, she's a truth teller. She is a rabble rouser. Never been afraid to say exactly what she thinks. Not afraid to get in trouble. She is a congresswoman from the great country of the United States of America. She happens to come from the state of Georgia, by the way, which is where my wife comes from, Moultrie, Georgia, down south, down there, as they say. Miss Cynthia McKinney, represented the state of Georgia, and she happens to be here because she flew into Donbass to do a bit of an expedition there with other notables to find out what's going on there. And she's good enough to grace us with her presence. So good to see you.
Well, it's great to see you. It's been too long. It's been a long time. But I love seeing you in this position in this studio.
You're so kind to say that. Yes, so she and I, when I was working at both MSNBC and CNN, she was one of the top dogs in Congress. She got a lot of airtime because she was not afraid to say a lot of things. And here is what is so weird that I have to start by saying this. And we're going to get to Donbass, and we're going to get to Charlie Kirk, and we're going to get to Gaza, and we're going to get to all those things. All the things that she used to say, and she was heavily bombarded for and criticized for, are the things that are being said today by everybody, including the people who used to criticize her.
Yes.
Tucker Carlson, Megyn Kelly, all of those people on the right who used to call you a crazy communist lefty, this, or the other.
They're
the ones now doing documentaries on 9/11 was maybe caused by the government.
Yes.
They said you were crazy for saying that.
Yes. Well, you know, all I did on September 11th, about September 11th, was I demanded an independent investigation.
Yeah.
And the president, who was Bush at the time, Vice President Cheney, it seemed like they were going all just out of their way to deny the people an investigation. So I ended up writing in the surprise that they published it in the Washington Post, an op-ed saying, well, normally when you have this kind of an accident, you would have the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, come in and do an impartial, nonpartisan, a real forensic investigation as to what happened so we could make sure that this kind of an accident didn't happen again. Mm. And that didn't happen either.
Right.
So then I said, okay, well, we've got to have an investigation. And all of a sudden, all of the walls closed in on me. And like you said, Tucker Carlson was saying nasty things about me. And all I wanted was an investigation.
Yeah.
Because clearly the official government line, which was, they hit us because we are free.
They don't like our freedom.
They don't like our freedom.
Exactly.
And that just didn't do it for me.
But you weren't allowed to say that at the time. It's almost like they were mad at you because you were saying things that were unpopular.
That's right.
Even if they are true.
They were mad at me. They were angry at me. And in fact, right after that, I lost my bid for re-election. Hmm. And so then I came back after 2 years. I came back again, and I won. And then I did the whole all-day briefing by the Jersey Girls and all of the people who had been doing their own personal independent investigations about what happened on September 11th.
Yeah.
And it became a part of the congressional record.
Listen, you were right about Gaza. you were right to criticize Israel. You were right about 9/11. You were right about the freedoms that were being lost in the United States. I could go down the list. I made a list as I was researching you today. Do you feel vindicated?
The easy answer would be, yes, I feel vindicated, but no, I don't feel vindicated. You know why?
Why?
Because I think about if people had believed me, like, for example, even, like, this week, I'm still receiving messages from X and other platforms where people are saying, at the time, I thought you were kook.
Yeah.
Because that's what the media had portrayed you to be.
Bingo.
And now you're a patriot. You were right. And I still get those messages. Like, now I'm still getting those messages. But what I think about is, suppose people had believed me 25 years ago when I was saying those things. Just imagine how much farther along our country could have been.
Yes. That's such a great point.
Yeah.
I mean, Tucker and I are friends. I like Tucker, but yeah, you know, there were a lot of people, including myself, who criticized you at the time. I can't remember exactly what about, but I'm sure I did. And that's okay. But here's Tucker now. He's got a 9/11 documentary coming out now where I just paid whatever it was, $20 for the rights to see it. He's going to make a whole lot of money on a documentary that's going to make money saying pretty much what you once said.
So did Michael Moore. You know, Michael Moore did Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah.
And that was basically everything that I had said about the Bush family making money and, you know, the group.
You mentioned Bush. I'm glad you did that, because you were really hard on George Bush. You basically called him out for a lot of things, including his incompetence. And when you did that, the Republican Party, that machine that exists there,
yes,
they literally targeted you like no one I've ever seen targeted before. What was that like? And did I get that right?
You got it right. And what it was like, well, I mean, you know, it's like, I'll tell you what, the way my parents, because now my mom and dad are looking at this, and they're so proud of their little girl who, you know, has gone all the way from Georgia all the way up to Washington, D.C., to the Congress. And all of a sudden, the person that they raised who was respectful, you know, genteel Southern lady, and all of a sudden now I'm a caricature of what they raised, and it was, you know, it was very hurtful for them and hurtful for me, too, because I didn't have enough money or power of my voice to defend myself.
Yeah.
So I just took it.
Yeah. You know what I do like that is happening now that I see? I don't know if you see it, and some people disagree with me on this when I have conversations about this. I'm starting to see that you are generally someone more on the liberal side. At least that's the way you kind of position yourself politically. Because in America, for those of you who don't understand America, you have to pick a side. You're not allowed to just be a person with lots of different variable opinions. You have to be a lefty or a righty, and you have to be a Republican or an avowed Democrat, which makes no damn sense. That's but whatever, it's what it's the way it is. What I'm now realizing that's happened in our country is that there are people on the left who believe what people on the right used to believe, and there are people on the right who believe what people on the left used to believe.
Yes.
And this whole party crap is not as important anymore.
It should not be, and it should never have been, because one of the very first lessons that I learned when I first went to Capitol Hill was that there was no difference. I saw the chairman of my committee walking out of a committee hearing where he had just vilified one of the witnesses, and they walked out arm in arm. And that let me know that it's all theater.
Yeah.
So then I began to understand how I needed to look at the events that were happening in Washington, D.C.
Huh.
Yes.
I got to ask you this, too. I have so many questions for you. I think you're just a fascinating and wonderful
person.
But now,
you know, let me just say that one of my favorite sayings now is that I'm so far left that I'm right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, I talk to a lot of the folks who do what I do for a living, you know, who now are on podcasts or independent mm-hmm. media like myself. And they say the same thing. They said, we don't give a crap anymore about what's left or right.
That's
we just
right.
tell the truth. And that's probably the way it should be. Since you were a congressperson, it behooves me to ask this question. It seems to those of us out here looking at our country and our government, mm-hmm. like every single person who is an elected official in Washington is at one point or another owned by something or someone. That you can't have the job without taking a legal bribe. Am I right?
I hate to...
I said legal.
I know, and sometimes illegal as well. like, for example, I had one guy come to me and say, you know, this president likes you, and not a U.S. president, and we can set you up with him. I mean, there's all kinds of bribes that are available if you say yes. And probably the first yes is, hey, we're going to play cards in Las Vegas. You want to go with us? And I said no to all of it.
Trips.
And I thought, yes, all of it. And I thought that I was elected to go to work. But, you know, the man down in the gym, the ladies in the salon. And so then who actually is running the government? It's the staff. And then those staffers can call yay or nay on any vote. Wow. I made it a practice that after I was embarrassed by one of my votes, I made it a practice that I would read every bill before I voted on it. And as a result of that, I became PNG, persona non grata.
Was it you? I don't remember if it was you, because you used to come on my show when I worked at CNN. I don't know if it was you or some other congressperson that I had on who told me, and maybe you can at least verify this or not, he or she told me 90% of their time working as a congresswoman or man was spent on the phone talking to donors.
Yes, that's right. And here's the thing.
Really? 90%?
Well, it probably now is 95%, you know, because The U.S. political system nowadays is that you can have a group of people, actually, you know, I'm a teacher, too, now.
Yeah.
And so I have the paradigm of social control that I teach my kids. And so I show them a picture of a bunch of men sitting around a table. And then our challenge is to name who those people are sitting around the table for any given issue. And then after we've gathered certain issues, then we say, now, who are the ones that are always at the table? Those are the ones who are calling the shots.
Interesting.
Yes. And so that is generally what it is. It's probably
so what you're saying is that the people we elect are not the people who are running the government.
Absolutely correct.
Wow.
Absolutely correct.
And they're always on the phone looking for money from people to give them
money. Now, let me tell you, so say that hearing on Capitol Hill where the chairman and the witness, who was supposed to be contentious but actually walked out arm in arm, that's my first lesson on Capitol Hill. My second lesson is guess what?
What?
The Democrats get the same donor list as the Republicans. So we're all calling the same people. So then, of course, if this little person over here actually believes in the mythology that Democrats and Republicans are different, this person is a victim.
Yeah.
That's
so,
right.
So in other words, if I make these cups of coffee and I want you to help my company and I'm going to give you money to do something to give me free no tax plan with my company that makes these cups of coffee, I go and I give $50,000 to you, the Democrat, and then I give another $50,000 to the Republican.
That's right.
The same thing.
That's right. And and I'll take it even further. So now you've got the members of Congress who understand that this is a game, and the game is actually being played on the people, not just of the United States, because, you know, one of the things that I used to say is that all roads lead to Washington, D.C. And so, as a result of that, the whole world is the playboard or pitch or playing field of the people in D.C.
Here's where the rubber meets the road. I just made this example. I don't really care if some guy who makes coffee in Georgia gets a tax break because he gave you and some other dude some money. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll be good in the end because he'll make more cups and hire more people. But when you start deciding wars and peace and which countries we back and which countries we don't, based on who gave the politicians money, which is, I'm sorry to say, what I see happening now in the Middle East, in Gaza, certainly what we see in Ukraine, issues having to do with NATO. You could even argue China to some respect. That's problematic.
Absolutely. And you've got members of Congress who understand that that's the game. And so on any report card, in any given report card, they are 50% here so they can get money from both sides. They're 50% there, so they get money from both sides, or they get money from all sides. But you're absolutely right. When we see Miriam Adelson write Donald Trump a check for I think that check was $75 million because she had already given $25 million. So one check, then let's think about these people sitting around this table.
Arguably, between her and her husband and other members of their family and their casino enterprise, they have given Mr. Trump somewhere around $350 million. That's a lot of money.
That buys a lot of ads on television.
So there's so much to get through, but we'll start with Donbass. We have some video of you, apparently, that we can show. Gene, if you have that, share the congresswoman or share the video of the congresswoman. There she is in the Donbass. Explain to us what we're watching here, why you were there, and why it is so meaningful to you.
So we were in Donetsk. And this is a memorial of the children who were killed. And I have to be honest with you, I try to pay attention to events that are happening around the world, but I have to be honest that I didn't realize that children were targeted in the way that they have been targeted by the U.S.-backed forces in this in the Donbass. I couldn't believe it. In fact, I was brought to tears.
These are from Donetsk, and it's one of the oblasts that where mostly the people who live there are Russians. They attend Russian churches. They speak Russian. They agree and identify as Russians. But it became part of Ukraine for a long time. And it didn't matter because the Ukrainians and the Russians are like cousins. They don't care. They all get along. And they don't care if you want to put a U in front of their name or an R in front of their name. Until NATO came there and started saying, no, we need the Ukrainians to hate the Russians because we're going to make them part of a NATO enterprise. And most people, like not myself, but, you know, Jeffrey Sachs and Professor Mearsheimer, Tucker Carlson, most of the people now know that that is what happened. Yes. And in the process, the Ukrainian army started blasting those four oblasts and punishing the people who live there for daring to say they wanted to be Russian.
Well, you know, those people are late. They are late to the game because we understand that the world is a chessboard. Who told us that? How many decades ago? So now, okay, so every country, no matter how big or no matter how small, is a square on this chessboard, ready to be played at any moment. And that it was just the turn for Ukraine.
It does fascinate me that we have created our enemies list. Russia's at the very top of it.
Yes.
China, Venezuela, Cuba. I mean, I could go on and on. The Israelis made us believe that all Muslims were essentially very bad people and all were should be suspected of being terrorists.
Yes.
It's such a shame, and I am guilty as a member of the media in the United States. I worked at Fox, I worked at CNN, I worked at NBC, as you know. You were on with me many times. Yes. And I bought into it and sold it as well. And I don't know where I got it. I guess it came down from Washington the way the media in the United States has played. But what a shame, because the citizenry wasn't allowed to understand that there may be another side to the story regarding China or Cuba or Venezuela or Russia, and that everybody in Russia doesn't wrestle bears and they're not all bad people.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, it took me, even as aware as I try to be, but when I started teaching on the other side of the planet, mm-hmm. then that's when it really hit me how steeped I was in a narrative that was not true.
You were one of the first people, the only people in the United States who stood up against not the second Gulf War. A lot of people were against the second Gulf War. It started to get obvious then. You were against the first Gulf War.
Yes.
When they told us that the Iraqis were going into some hospital in Kuwait and smashing the heads of babies and taking them out of incubators, and they used a public relations and marketing company to convince the American people of that, you called them out and said, no, that's bullcrap.
Yes, yes. And as a result of that, I was vilified and scorned. This is back when I was in the Georgia legislature. And I stayed up all night that night because what I was looking at, actually, it looked beautiful. It looked like fireworks, but it was death.
Yeah.
And so I stayed up and I was writing. And when I got to the part of my speech where I said, George Bush ought to be ashamed of himself.
Mm-hmm.
All of my colleagues got up and walked out on me.
Ugh.
And then they changed the rules of this is the Georgia House of Representatives. They changed the rules so that we would say the Pledge of Allegiance every day. And instead of turning around and facing the flag, guess what? The leadership of the Georgia House, they turned to me and faced me to look at me to make sure I was saying the Pledge of Allegiance. They're the ones, by going along with this death and destruction and war machine and not questioning it, they're the ones who were traitors to the Constitution, not me.
No, you were right. You've been vindicated. You were right about the first Gulf War. You were right about the second Gulf War. There was no reason to go to war with these countries. We were doing it at the behest of Israel, another country that you've been challenging and taking on. I think it was in 2008 that you were on a boat that was rammed by the IDF. You were part of a Gaza relief organization, and you were trying to take supplies to the children and the people there. You were kidnapped by Israel, you have written.
Yes.
With crayons that you were taking to kids. That was those were the weapons that you were using, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that right?
Well, that's right, but that's a little bit late, too. Because actually, when I was in the Congress, I began to understand that U.S. support for Israel constituted a war crime and made a war criminal out of our own presidents. I began to understand. It's like I was in Malaysia, and I said to them, I didn't know what Zionism was until I got targeted by Zionists, right? And what I began to do was every piece of legislation that mentioned Israel, I made sure that I read every line of it because I wanted to know what I was voting on. Now, I ended up voting against them, and then Nita Lowey, who was at that time the representative from New York State, she said to me, Cynthia, every vote has a consequence. So they had done everything. They had tried to get me to hire a chief of staff who was loyal to AIPAC. I refused to do that. They had done everything to sort of penetrate my office and to understand just exactly what I was doing.
Who's they?
The pro-Israel people inside Washington. And of course, every member of Congress, they know more about you. Trust me, they know more about you than you know about yourself.
Wow.
And they make it their business to know more about you. I have one member of Congress who told me the story. I don't know if we have time. But she told me the story about how she got entrapped by them. They offered to do her campaign records for free. They offered her a CPA, certified public accountant.
Hmm.
He did her campaign records, and then with no problem. And then he offered to do her personal income tax records.
Uh-oh.
And then she would call me Cindy, and she's still there, by the way. And she said, Cindy, I realized at that point that they knew everything about me.
Yeah.
So now she's trapped.
And would use it. Yeah.
That's
right. Did you get, I'm wondering, because now this is so out in the open, everybody's angry about Israel's control of the United States. Israel tells the United States what to do, who to bomb, where to spend its money.
Yes.
And they totally control the Congress because they bought them all.
Yes.
Did you ever get somebody in Congress saying, you know, Cynthia, don't go up against these folks. First of all, they're very powerful.
Yeah.
And besides, shut up. They'll give you money.
Yeah.
You can get a lot of money here. Just be quiet and pretend. Look the other way.
Yeah, all the time. I mean, yeah. In fact, the the congresswoman that told me that story was telling me, you know, you're too smart. You we need you here.
Don't get in the way.
But
take the money.
Well, yeah, but I mean, all of my smartness, and I couldn't, maybe it's something about this Catholic thing, because I didn't realize that about
you're Catholic.
Charlie Kirk.
Yeah. So am I, yeah.
And, but the Catholics taught me one very important thing, and that's how to think for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And
St. Thomas Aquinas.
And
free
they
will.
They said, you know it better than me, and they said that if you have a talent, that it's like a sin to waste the talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the ability to communicate very well with my public. And so I did that. And they wanted me to communicate their message to my public. I was offered, this was before Sudan split.
Right.
That and Sudan didn't split. Sudan was purposely Balkanized.
Right.
That's right. And they wanted me to get arrested in front of the Sudan embassy. And they told me, you know, they had Nat Hentoff, who was working at the Village Voice or something. He called me and he said, Cindy, when are you going to play ball on Sudan? And I said, I'm already playing ball on Sudan, because I had introduced legislation to delist from the U.S. stock market any U.S. corporation that was participating in crimes against humanity in Sudan.
Right.
But that wasn't exactly what they wanted.
No.
So I always was trying to figure out a way to outdo or to outmaneuver them, and I found out that it is possible to do so.
There has to be enough. We have to figure, and you're right. I mean, St. Thomas Aquinas wrote that, and that's one of the beacons of Catholicism, that we, from God, get this thing called free will,
mm-hmm.
which allows us to think and say. And if we don't do that, it's a sin.
That's right.
We have to tell the truth.
We
have to not live on the cusp of lies, et cetera, et cetera. And I do think that's important. I see it flourishing now more than ever. I love the fact that podcasters now have bigger audiences than CNN. Fox and CNN and NBC and CBS and ABC and BBC and even the New York Times and Le Monde and all these people, they do not deserve to have big audiences, because they're bought and owned.
They're owned
by others. And those are the people who attacked you
That's
relentlessly
right.
That's all the time.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So I was invited after all of my adventures. You're right. I tried to get into Gaza 3 times. I actually got there, not by sea, but by land on the third attempt. And when I got there, the interesting thing is the first thing we see as we're coming in from the Rafah crossing is a wedding. And what that showed me is that there's love still in Gaza, despite, I mean, rubble everywhere. I don't know what Israel bombs, because even back then, it was all rubble, right? So they bomb and bomb and bomb and bomb the same things over and over and over again. And yes, they bomb schools, they bomb university, they bomb people's homes, they bomb everything.
With the weapons that your colleagues in Congress give them and vote for and increase every single year.
Well, you know, look, I said no to all of the enticements, right? But you're sitting on the budget committee, and you've got the chairman of the Federal Reserve in your office, and the chairman is telling you, okay, well, you know, this stock is going to be really good. And so now you're going to give that up?
Is that how McConnell, for example, has a job that pays $250,000, but he's worth $43 million? Is that how do you have a job that pays how much were you paid back then?
160 or 170.
So most people are paid somewhere between $150,000 and $200,000.
Yeah.
Senators are paid a little bit more, closer to $250,000. And yet within 10 years of having that job and keeping it, they're all worth $30 million, $40 million.
Well, now, you know,
how does that happen?
Well, now, there's another phenomenon that I only recently learned about. Well, not recently, but after I left the Congress that I learned about. And that is the, how can I say, the financial reward given to insiders who participate in regime change operations. So, for example, we have the instance of Kosovo. And actually, there was a documentary made about how Madeleine Albright, I call Madeleine Albright out because she was wearing diamond earrings, right? And the person who escorted her, of course, I wasn't expected to talk about this, but the person who was her escort while she was Secretary of State is one of the diamond guys, or was one of the diamond guys. So I called her out on her diamond earrings because they're blood diamonds. Well, anyway, then I find out that it was people like her and Wesley Clark and all of these other people who were insiders on regime change, like, for example, in Kosovo, they're on the backside getting contracts.
Yeah, with Raytheon and Aerodynamic and all the other, Pratt & Whitney.
So now, if we look at the appropriation of the money for Ukraine,
right,
and we look at the players in the Congress who are, whose children are now doing something, or were at that time doing something of high importance in Ukraine, and the children, you know, are movie makers and doing, but the last thing they are is geopolitical consultants, right? I mean, you know, that's not their training. Well, this is another form of that same kind of corruption.
So explain it to us better, if you could. I want to understand it. So you're a member of Congress, and you know, because nobody else knows, but you know that you've just appropriated enough funds to be able to have U.S. weaponry sent to and used in a conflagration that's about to break out in Ukraine. You know that. Nobody else knows that. You can immediately then invest in any of these companies who will make those weapons, and you will get sort of rich from that.
That's right. Or if you're, depending on how well-placed you are inside the Congress, you can actually, or your children or your brother or brother-in-law can actually get a contract for the rebuilding or a contract for, you know, because this is what, and there was a documentary that I saw that spelled it out with Madeleine Albright, and, you know, it's another form of corruption.
And do you think all, all these people, it turns out, are Madeleine Albright, is a Zionist. I mean, she's basically, you know.
Yes.
She worked for Israel all this time. And it's funny because she was also, as you said, responsible for the bombing of Belgrade for something like 3 months, where, according to the Wilson Center, as many as 2,000 people may have died. And yet here we are making NATO out to be this wonderful organization that's just there to defend freedom and democracy. They attacked Iraq. They stayed 20 years in Afghanistan. They bombed Belgrade. Now they're doing the same thing in Ukraine. Are they really a defensive organization?
No, they're not. They're very much on the offense. And they are offensive as well.
They're aggressors.
That's right. That's right. Well, and to my value system, they're offensive too. I mean, so. Then what are we to do? We have no choice but to call the spade that it is. And that's what I've done. And, you know, there's something you just have to suck it up and say, okay, I'm going to get call names. People are going to hate me for a while, but I hope that eventually what they'll see is that I was telling the truth. And now, 25 years later, I've got people who are writing to me and they're saying just that.
Have you had anyone reach out to you? Some of these people I know and respect. You know, on the right, who are now saying what you said. And I would almost think not to tell them what they need to do, but might not be a bad idea to apologize.
Well, it would be a nice thing to have someone apologize, you know, but I don't see it coming, and it hasn't happened as of yet. And in fact, those names whom you have called have not even spoken my name. So I'm the one who has to be ignored. In fact, you know, I was there the whole time when Kurt Weldon was doing what he was doing, and then after the way he was treated as well. He's another member of Congress who's been mistreated. But
there's a good one left, Massey, Tom Massey.
Oh, Thomas Massey is my guy. Yeah. I mean, you know.
He's my hero.
Yes, absolutely, because he's saying. Now,
when people come into his office and try to bribe him or try and tell him what to do, whether it's Israel or some weapons manufacturer, he tells them to go to hell.
Yeah, and that's very good.
There's a couple, right? Like, well, there's not. I mean, I wish we could.
I think there's Thomas Massey.
So there's one.
Yes, but you know what? Here's the thing. As I was just saying not very long ago, is if we wanted to see transformational change within the structure or the institution of the U.S. Congress, you know how many people I estimate that it would take in order to do that? Five.
Really?
We don't need 218 in the House. No, we don't. We need 4 members of the U.S. House.
Right.
And we need 1 senator who is willing to use the powers of the position. So now, you combine the power of the position with the power of principle and conscience. And I believe that with only 5 members, that we could transform, particularly now at this time when there's an awakening. Because everything that I've said, I mean, I haven't said anything that wasn't true. The things that I was saying back then are things that are wearing well now, 25 years later.
But there are forces right now inside the United States, my country, your country, that we love and respect for its people, its principles, and its constitution, that are working to make sure that those 5 people do not exist and cannot do that. And once they raise their head and they discover them, they will take them out. And you know that.
Well, that's that...
I don't mean they're going to assassinate them. I mean they will take them out politically. They will run someone against them. They will run stories about them.
And they will pour money into their campaigns and they'll
And they'll have one term. Because that's the way it happens. Am I wrong?
I'm hopeful that... I mean, technically... You're right in the methodology that would be employed against that person. However, there are enough of us who have been victimized by those bad people who now are having a kind of renaissance. Like, heck, I'm getting ready to start doing my podcasting again. I mean, you know? So if we amplify our voices, those come from the right people. You could trust me 25 years ago, you can trust me today. And that's the message that we give in support of those five people. I think we might stand a chance.
Cynthia McKinney, wow, what a story. And you have been through so much. And as we used to say back in the old days, you're keeping on trucking.
Keeping on trucking.
You are still going and you're still being a truth teller and you're still trying to make a change in this world.
That's right.
And you know what? Thank you. Thank you. It's so good to see you. Thanks for sharing your ideas and your courage with our millions of people all over the world who I'm sure are going to be watching this interview. And they're also saying in their hearts, thank you for what you've done.
Wow. Thank you.
We appreciate it. Thank you so much. Cynthia McKinney. Wow. What a story. We're finally out of time. That's it for us. You know, I have a podcast. It's called Journalistically Speaking, and you can bet your bottom dollar that a lot of these comments and conversations that we and I just had, me and the Congresswoman, are going to be on there as well. And they're also going to be on X, where lately I've been noticing this morning I looked up and there were 350,000 people who had looked at just some of the stuff that we posted this morning on X. So we're getting a lot of traction. Thank you. Thank you for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is The Sanchez Effect. And we'll be looking for you next time.